I would also like to thank the organizers for inviting me here, and to Christoph in particular for giving me this nice introduction. Actually, there isn't much for me to say in this. So the outline of my talk would be as follows. I would first of all explain a little bit more in detail about two-body universality and quantum halo systems. I will then go over to Feshbach molecules in cold gases, where one can tune actually the scattering lengths, which gives interesting perspectives. I will talk a little bit about the systems where one has studied Efimov physics in the past. Then go over to the way that they are actually probed in the cold gases. We'll tell you something about the possibility of detecting excited Efimov resonances, as Christoph already indicated, and then go over to the production of Efimov states in optical lattices. So let me start quite generally. What is a quantum halo system? A quantum halo system would be a system in which the average separation between the constituent particles exceeds the distance scale set by the classical motion in the potential well. So there are some classic examples of this behavior. There would be the helium dimer system, there would be the deuteron system, and the modern examples are the Feshbach molecules. How does it work? So we have a two-particle Hamiltonian, which in this helium case is a pretty simple one. We just have a kinetic energy term, and we have a molecular potential. The potential drops off like C6 over R to the 6. And now we can think about that we could, in principle, think about moving this inner wall of this potential here, the Pauli repulsion. That would shift a bound state, which is somewhere here in the potential, right up to the threshold. In helium, the nature does it for us. In the Feshbach systems, one can do it by design. We could then parameterize our bound state energy by a length scale, which will later turn out to be the scattering length. And one can always show then that the bound state wave function has a long distance behavior of this nature. Actually, this is just the solution of the free Schrödinger equation. And the reason for this being a solution of the free Schrödinger equation is simply that the potential goes to zero, and we just have a free Schrödinger equation, which describes our system on these length scales. So in the helium case, there would be this bound state right up to the threshold. There is no other bound state in the system, and we have this wave function, which is extended over the potential well. So what is so special about these systems? First of all, it is that these systems are just described by a single parameter in the two-body system, which would be which one can identify with the two-body scattering length, which is often referred to as universality. But the most remarkable thing about these systems comes in when one looks at the relevant length scales for the system. So when I take this bound state wave function that I had before, which just depends on the scattering length, I can calculate the average interatomic distance between the particles, which turns out to be half of the scattering length. And now I look at the classical motion that a particle would have with such an energy. So in a classical sense, when I put a particle in there with such an energy, it would just oscillate within this potential well up to an outer classical turning point. This outer classical turning point in this potential can be characterized through the van der Waals length in a very simple way. And the characteristic property of these halo states is that they are classically forbidden. Means to say that most of the time the particles will spend outside the range of distances which would be allowed by their classical motion in this potential well at that particular energy that we would have. So how does that work out? For instance, here, for one example, the bond length of helium would be 5 nanometer. The outer classical turning point would be 1.4 nanometer. And we see indeed that the scattering length is much larger than the than these classical turning points. So we have a halo state. So now we have the fascinating possibility in the cold gases to tune scattering lengths. I have just taken another example that would be the rubidium-85 example. Here we would have two resonances, as Paul already explained to us, Paul Julian, they can be broad and they can be narrow. And all that we need to know here in this talk is that these resonances appear, these singularities of the scheduling lengths appear always when there is a vibrational bound state coming to the threshold. In both cases, it does that in here. So we can look at what has been measured about the bound state energies. This comes from the, I would possibly say, first experiments on the Feshbach molecules in Wyman's group. These green dots are the measured energies. We have the blue dots, couple channels calculations from this paper here. And one can describe it with a two-channel theory, which I will not dwell on in detail. But as one can see, when one takes this easy parameterization to the scattering length, these curves merge when one comes closer to the resonance positions, which would here be at 155 Gauss. We can plot that in a bit more favorable way, and that links it to the Efimov physics. When we plot the square root of energy as a function of 1 over A, we would have that these universal formula would just show a straight line. And now we can see actually what's happening at the resonance. When we come in at negative scattering lengths, that would be this part, we get 1 over A going to 0 in this case. At the point 1 over A equals 0, the bound state appears, and we can actually see that these experiments fall reasonably nicely on a straight line, at least as we approach the resonance position. A second thing which one can show that independently of the complications of this potential, here we have several scattering channels because we tune the scattering length through the interaction, different interactions of particles in different Zeeman states. These particles would, these Feshbach molecules would still be described by halo wave functions. And the range of these wave functions will increase the closer I get to the resonance position, especially the distance scale more and more exceeds this outer classical turning point of the motion of the particles. So one experiment which shows actually these features is an experiment also performed in Carl Wyman's group, where they looked at rubidium-85, which is in an excited state, which has decay via spin relaxation. So two particles can collide. One particle goes up into a lower state and releases the energy into the relative motion, and the particles leave the traps. One can look at the spin relaxation of a molecular state as a function of the magnetic field strength, and what one sees is that the lifetime grows when one comes to the resonance position. The interpretation is the following. So I'm doing very dumb things here, but one can justify them more rigorously. When we attach a volume to a halo state, just according to this simple formula and the halo wave function, we get pi a cubed out of it. So remember that the distance scale is the scattering length here. So now we just look at the rate equation for the spin relaxation and put in, this is the average density, and put in an average density for two particles using just this volume. We end up with a simple formula for the lifetime of this Feshbach molecule, and this is the red line. And actually, we can see that indeed the experiments support exactly this view, that the lifetime of these Feshbach molecules increase due to the larger extent of the bound state wave function. So let me switch to the three-body system in this case. So this will be the only slide about detailed theory, because everything that I will show you from now on is some kind of numerical exact solutions of the three-particle Schrödinger equation, which is either in free space or in an optical lattice. So we have, in the optical lattice case, I will just use the harmonic confinement in one side. So we have a center of mass part. We have a part which describes the coordinate from one particle to the center of mass of two other particles. And we have the relative coordinate between two of the particles in here. and reduce the sum of the pair interactions as the interaction in the three-particle system. So, now we have seen that there are some kind of strange quantum phenomena happening for two particles, and we have already heard that there are then also predictions on strange quantum phenomena in the three-particle system. I put that again for the example of the helium system. There are two sides of this story. The first side was already predicted in 1935, where Thomas has actually shown via a variational estimate that the energy of a three-particle stage is not described by, not necessarily described by the characteristic energy of the two-particle stage. So what he showed was that actually if one has arbitrarily weak binding in the two-body system, the three-body state can still have arbitrarily large energy. Depending on the range of the forces, it can actually diverge. That's the one side of the thing. In the helium, we see this here in the ground state. It has somehow 100 times more energy than the shallow dimer bound state. And there was another remarkable phenomenon that was actually discussed in the last talk, predicted by Efimov, is that the number of these three-body states can also decrease over all limits as I tune the scattering length to infinity. And it has this logarithmic dependence, and if we put in just the numbers for the helium here, for instance, we would get 0.8 out, so on the order of 1. And actually what we can see is that in the helium systems there are two states of this three-body system, a ground state and an excited state. That was suggested in this paper. These states have been detected. The ground state detection is from 1994, and a recent measurement actually confirmed the bond length of this system to agree with the experiments. So when we are now want to study Efimov physics, we can just have a look at how that actually works out. I've shown you the wave functions, and Efimov is explaining the whole thing to us here. What he shows is an Efimov plot, actually. So this is also what we have seen from Christoph already, just parameterized in the way that Efimov originally suggested. So we plot 1 over A over the square root of the bound state energy, and we can see that these three particle states emerge in a zero energy resonance somewhere at negative scattering length. So then they actually live a while, but we can see here for this state actually that they vanish in an atom dimer resonance on the other side of positive scattering length. And in principle, all these states would be self-similar. So that the scenario would repeat itself with the periodicity that Christoph outlined in his talk. However, at the moment, we are at the point that one can only probe the ground state levels of this scenario. So we have a three-body zero energy resonance in the ground state, but one can show, and that has been done in these two works here by Bruch and Efimov, that the ground state inevitably connects to non-universal physics in the system. In this work, for instance, it was shown that the ground state energy is always 3 times bigger than the ground state energy of the dimer system, which means that this state can never cross the threshold. How does that then look in the examples that we have? So in the measurement of the helium system, we have a ground state system where one is just on this line of the plot. Remember, one cannot change the scattering length of the helium system itself. And there is this excited state. So the excited state has not been found yet, but the helium system itself would be universal in the sense that when we know this energy, we can actually predict what this energy would be in this system. There's another case in the triton where one believes that there is similar behavior in the system. That is what Efimov pointed out to us, actually. But as we can see, the ground level is never universal throughout. We have a similar situation in the cesium experiments. Here's the region of positive scattering lengths, as Christoph has already shown. There's a zero energy resonance, which is the first one to appear after the zero crossing of the scattering length. So zero crossing would mean lower and lower interactions in the system. And this one here now belongs to a Borromean ground level, means to say that there is no dimer state energetically above it, in the sense. This is a novelty. So Borromean means that when I remove one of the particles from the trimer, the remnant parts fall apart, like these three Borromean rings. So, and when one wants to have a full picture of this story, we are just writing up a colloquium together with two of the heroes of this story, that's Peter Tönjes and Rudi Grimm. So, let's come to the prospects of the research. Can we actually see excited states in the system, which would be a very significant and interesting advance? The way that the systems are probed in cold gases at the moment is that one looks at three-body recombination. I've just shown it to you for one example, that would be rubidium-87, where one has a resonance at 1007 Gauss, which leads to a enhancement of the three-body recombination rate. One has structure in here, and the resonance coincides with a point where the diatomic level, which I have indicated here by the dashed and dot dashed lines, becomes degenerate with the threshold. So the point that I would like to make here is that actually one can describe this three-body recombination in a quite accurate way for these simple systems. So this would be the predicted line. And there are two independent measurements which actually confirm our calculations to quite a degree of accuracy. So that gives hope for future studies of three-body recombination, I hope. Now one can do the same for the cesium experiments, and as was already outlined, these were the first experiments, I think, where one actually systematically studied the structure of the system. There's this famous minimum here where they did the condensation in the cesium system. And there is this resonance peak when one of the Efimov levels comes degenerate with the threshold. And when we do our theory, we are not quite on top of it. I will outline why that is in a minute. But at least one can see that actually these calculations confirm that there should be a peak, and also that this peak coincides with a position where one of these metastable trimer levels becomes degenerate with the threshold itself. So the question is, can we now see an excited state? What Christoph didn't say, perhaps, which would be have been helpful, is that actually this part of this plane here, of the scattering length, is only one part of a resonance in what we would call mirror spin channel. The systems are prepared now in the Zeeman ground state, MF equals 3, and there is a resonance actually in the MF equals minus 3, which triggers the variation of the scattering length in the MF equals 3 system. So there is actually a resonance which one could access if one just flipped the orientation in this to MF equals minus 3. And as there is a resonance, so as the scattering length goes to infinity, one could actually measure an excited state resonance somewhere in the vicinity of minus 9 Gauss in this system, according to this calculation. However, there is a problem related to the fact that on the other side, we are not in the ground state, in the Zeeman ground state, so we can have spin relaxation, so we have competing loss mechanisms, and it may be difficult to do this. So one way out would be measurements at 800 Gauss, as also Christoph has outlined. There's another resonance feature where we can see the full glory of this scenario, and there it would be possible to see an A2 resonance somewhere at predicted at 815 Gauss or something like that. What we also have is a possibility of reducing the loss in this system through having a minimum of three-body recombination, so it may allow the Bose-Einstein condensation of cesium in the vicinity of 800 Gauss, similarly to what happened in the low field region. So that would be very helpful, I think. However, I would like to caution a little bit here. Our theory cannot fully take into account the complexity of the cesium interactions. So what we are taking into account is two bound states and their magnetic field variation and their spin admixtures in this case, so a two-channel approach, so to speak. But as we can see, there are lots and lots of other levels which couple much weaker to the continuum, but still they do couple. A second point that I would like to make is that actually there is a strong magnetic field variation of these target states for three-body recombination, which means actually that these short distance parameters in the analytic theory should actually depend on the magnetic field. At least in our calculations, they do quite significantly depend on it, as one can see here in this comparison. When I plot the K3 loss rate constant versus the scattering length on this graph, we see that there's pronounced differences between the low field case, which has been measured, and the actual high field case, which has not yet been measured, which would be the 800 Gauss resonance, whereas if everything was flat and the same in the two cases, they should actually coincide, these curves. Another thing that happens, of course, is we are at the moment here with the scattering length, seeing the resonance at that point, but there is quite a way to go to the excited state resonance. So in the last part of the talk, I would therefore like to point out a way perhaps to see excited state features by actually producing these Efimov trimer molecules. And one system which would be particularly well suited for this purpose would be a system with a negative background scattering length. The reason for this is that depending on the background scattering length, we can actually access different parts of this Efimov plane of 1 over A. We have a negative background scattering length. We are limited on the negative scattering length side by the background scattering length. So we go down here. That means we go up here in this. So we come back here and go to A equals 0, where A 1 over A goes to plus infinity in this. So one can access the whole range from 0 to plus infinity, but one cannot access this range. And it happens, for instance, in this rubidium 85 system that actually the ground state resonance appears should appear somewhere at B equals naught if it is not shifted actually outward the accessible ranges of magnetic field strengths. So the only resonance that is available would be the excited state resonance. It's this. So it would allow an easy access to an excited trimer state of the system. And how can we actually associate the things? I mean, with all the pre-work, that is now pretty simple. We know how to do that for the diatomic systems by just looking at the spectrum of diatomic levels in this. So we have the separated atoms where we would prepare the things. These are the discrete levels of one oscillator of the optical lattice site. So if we sweep across the resonance in the system, that would be rubidium 87 in this example, we would just shift each level one lower. And the lowest level we would shift into the diatomic bound states. So it's just an adiabatic connection. Having these zero energy resonances in the three-body sector, actually the picture looks the same. That would be now rubidium 85, where this magnetic field variation is just reversed. So we would start on this side with the free atoms. And if we plot it with respect to the dimer threshold here in the whole plot, we would just go from the lowest state here to this excited trimer stage, because the other resonance is out of commission in this system. Reason, or what do these states look like? I mean, this is a plot for different lattice parameters. That would be a realistic, that would squeeze it quite heavily here. So we have the ground state, we have the first excited state, which has somehow the extent of the diatomic Feshbach molecule. So the length scales and energy scales of the system are quite reasonable, actually, when one compares it to the diatomic systems. So it's not anything monstrous that should come out of it. And the second thing that I want to point you to is, if we want to really do physics with these systems, means to say probe the states and produce them, it would be greatly advantageous to have an excited state, because as in the diatomic system, intrinsic relaxation mechanism, which would be something like three-body recombination in a trimer, should be reduced by increasing the size of the system in here. So, to speak, that these excited states should be much longer lived than the ground states, and that perhaps may allow people to actually probe these systems. So, with this I would like to conclude. So I hope I have shown to you that near-resonant diatomic Feshbach molecules are halo states, that the halo nature of these systems implies Efimov's effect in the associated three-body system. At the moment, we have a Borromean ground level seen in the cesium experiments. One could measure excited state resonances in the vicinity of 800 Gauss, preferably. And one could actually produce metastable excited Efimov trimers in cold gases of species with a negative background scattering length, preferably. There would be, for instance, the example of rubidium-85 just using magnetic field sweep techniques in the same way as one does it with the diatomic molecules. Yeah, thank you.
Are there any questions?
There is another interesting atom, lithium-7, has also in F equal to negative background. Can you make the calculation in this case also?
Yeah, actually you pointed that out to me in Ohio at a conference and said that there was some kind of enormous difficulties you had with the diatomic molecules that you produced with respect to the stability. The strange thing about the lithium resonance is it's terribly broad, so it looks very good. But as Paul already pointed out, it is kind of a closed channel dominated resonance. So from that viewpoint, we would expect rapid relaxation because the overlap factors of the initial particles and the final target states should be unfavorably big for such a system. So I think that would be not such a good example for that with respect to the stability. So one would have to go to very high scattering lengths to really realize something that is reasonably stable in this.
Yeah, I missed an important point. So just to get the feasibility right, if you plug in the numbers for doing that in a lattice for rubidium-85, for example, uh-huh. What are the problems going to be just by three-body collisions, inelastic three-body collisions, before I even have the chance to sweep into this Efimov state? I mean, is there any chances? If you look at the rates there, I mean, usually when we put three atoms on rubidium-87 together, they're already gone very fast. So is there any hope of realistic hope of doing that?
The question is, I mean, you probably have a better feeling for it because you have done the experiments already. The question is whether one could actually start from conditions here where one has already a reasonably reduced three-body recombination rate, so gets these things reasonably stable that when the three particles collide do not form dimer molecules. I haven't done the specific calculations of that kind for the lattice sites, but I would presume that there are features in the same way as in the, let me go back to the rubidium-87. I mean, there could be features where you have minima of recombination, where you could efficiently suppress it. If the first resonance then is this excited trimer state, there may be a way to associate them. That's a question. It's certainly not... they all look in principle more or less the same, these plots. It's just that the magnitudes are shifted, so one has to calculate and really think where to start. Yeah.
Just need a clarification about what you say about the lifetime. So when the dimer gets bigger, the bond length gets bigger, so the probability of finding three particles in close vicinity is small. That's why
lifetime. You release the density, you have some decay mechanism. In principle, it doesn't really make a difference what it is. In the case that I've shown you for the diatomic molecules, it was the spin relaxation. So if you make the wave function bigger and bigger, there is less probability of finding these particles closer together, so you reduce the collision rate. In this molecular state.
So what you are saying is, if I'm sitting right at the resonance, scan all these states, if I go to the high energy trimers, the width is getting narrower and narrower. That's what you are saying.
For the diatomic systems, yes, because you can tune the size of the molecule just by increasing the scattering length.
Yeah.
For the triatomic systems, there is a barrier in the system which one gets out. This is actually what is part of this paper here. It's shown when you do your adiabatic hyperspherical description, you can see that there is a barrier in there, so you will not get the size of the state to infinite extent. But the tendency is that, of course, the higher excited the states are, the more the extent of the state is, actually.
So I have a comment and a question. So the comment is regarding the Feshbach resonances, good Feshbach resonances for Effimov physics. I think the potassium 39 resonance, Massimo's resonance, where he produced this potassium 39 BEC, has very interesting properties. It seems to be sufficiently broad and sits on a moderate negative background. So for me, this would be a very interesting candidate to look into this. Now the question is, from the experimental point of view, it's easy to do dimer physics. We can have a trapped sample of dimers and collide these dimers and measure inelastic decay of the dimers. So, and we see structure in it. So it's a four-body process. Can you say anything about four-body physics or phenomena and four-body physics?
The only thing that I can say is that other people have looked into it before me. I haven't done any specific calculations on it, so shouldn't really answer this question. Because it would lead to speculation simply. Yeah.
The condensed matter and less about the very few body quantum problem. Is there any general lesson from the Efimov analysis of trimers that carries over into larger strongly correlated systems? So for example, in a lattice of dimers and single atoms, or a lattice of trimers and with these things tunneling around, is there any lesson, or is this such a just a special case of the success of exact few body quantum physics that there's really not a clear extension of its validity?
I would say that the simplest lesson to learn from this is that the correlations in a system of bosons are much more complicated than they would be in a system of fermions. And that is certainly one signature of it, that you actually, when you have S-wave interactions between all the particles, you actually have this complicated behavior of infinitely many bound states, which certainly leads to the instabilities in the gases that one can see, in the Bose gases that one can see when one goes to the resonance position. That would be my main conclusion of this physics, and this is actually one of the simplest implementations of this. So the three-particle problem being the simplest problem with reaction channels, and then all the complexity that comes in, that one also has in the many-particle system, where one can actually solve something exactly, whereas in the many-particle system, it's hard.
One final question by Paul.
I'll just briefly comment on Dan's question, perhaps, about the relevance for condensed matter or lattices. And there may be some possibility of tuning three-body interactions. You showed minima and maxima and so forth. So, for example, if you had a system that was tunneling between sites and some sites were triply occupied, is the recombination going to kill the site? Or perhaps could you tune it and make it very small? So tunability of three-body is an interesting thing to think about, perhaps. Atom-dimer relaxation is another thing that we don't understand very well yet. and we need to think about that and what tunability might exist in that.
I mean, one famous example is the condensation of cesium, which wouldn't have been possible without reduction of three-body loss, isn't it? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So. Yeah. Well. Yeah.
Let's thank the speaker one last time.